Hey, everybody. This is Kevin Williams with the Oneida Admissions Consulting Podcast, and this is for Wednesday, April 11th, 2012, but we are recording this actually on Sunday, on Easter Sunday, because we are champions like that. So anyway, today is I have a guest here, and this is an interview with Delano. He's a friend of mine. He's an accomplished young professional. And he's gracious enough to have us sit down and have a conversation with us here today. So that being said, just real quick on Delano, he was born and raised in St. Louis, Missouri. He went off to college, and you know he went to Wall Street after that, and went off to business school at HBS, and then kind of had a successful career in finance. I'll let you kind of fill in the blanks and, you know, add to that, you know, how you see fit. Go ahead.
Sounds good. Well, first of all, Kevin, thanks for having me. And, yeah, basically, as Kevin said, I worked in, I started working as an investment banking analyst out of undergrad, worked for a startup business for a year, and then worked for a small private equity firm before going to business school. Graduated from business school and am now, or have been working again in finance, and now work for a small hedge fund.
There you go. All right, dude. By the way, I didn't know you worked for the startup thing before business school. Mm-hmm. Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh,
I didn't know that. 1 year, it blew up.
Oh, okay. Nice. Sorry. Well, I didn't mean to.
Yeah. Still, I've spent a lot of time with my therapist to get over it. So.
That's hilarious. Yeah. But, so how we meet? We basically met through the internship program, though, the SEO. That's when we basically, uh-huh, right, to go to SEO.
Right,
yeah. Yeah, and for those of you who don't
college.
Know, yeah, those of you who don't know what SEO is, it's a say basically like an internship program. The whole idea is to get people of color on Wall Street, and now it's grown to be much broader than that, like into the field of law and nonprofit, and I think even alternative investments. They've got programs for that stuff. Yeah, man, that was summer of 1997, and You went to like one firm. You had your, you know, the firm that you worked at, and then in the evenings you would go around to other firms for presentations from like their CEO and division heads. That's basically what the benefit of it was, and you would network. And the idea is by the end of the summer you'd have more interviews than you otherwise would have. Basically, so yeah, no, it was good. All right, so I want most of this to be about kind of, you know, what we did after college, but real quick on kind of college, just what did you major in, and how do you feel, like we get a lot of people after our presentations that come up to us after, like, hey, you know, does it matter what you major in? If you want to be this for the rest of your life, do you have to have a hard major? Can you do something soft? You know, do you have to have like a minor that complements your major? You know, how would you give any, first of all, what was yours, and what would you say is some good advice to just, you know, people depending on what they want to do as well.
Sure. Well, my major was finance, and I knew that I was interested in working in some capacity in finance, ideally on Wall Street. So I was lucky enough to find an opportunity and start my career doing what I wanted to be doing. But for me, it was a great fit. It was what I wanted to do. I think for young people coming out right now, I would give two-pronged advice. My advice would be study something that interests you, but also make sure you study something that is more quantitative. I think that it allows kids to position themselves for more opportunities by having studied something harder, like, or more quantitatively oriented, such as engineering, math, econ, you know, business and finance, et cetera.
That's classic dad advice right there, man. That's,
well, I think,
it
probably is. I think, clearly, you know, I'm not an 18, 19, 20-year-old, but it appears to me that the world has just gotten increasingly competitive and increasingly global. And while it was already competitive and global when I was coming up, it appears to be more so now. And I think one of the things I've seen amongst my peers from that period in time, or even now, is that it's not knowing numbers and not being good in math is almost the equivalent now to being illiterate, in my opinion.
Now, clearly, I think this certainly applies, and if anyone wants to kind of ultimately work in the field of business, in particular high finance, but would you also give similar advice to someone who wants to ultimately be a lawyer or go into journalism?
Yes.
Or go into, you know, even theater for, you know,
those
aspiring artists out there.
Well, the one thing that often happens for people who are in more kind of creatively oriented fields is they say to themselves, or they say openly that, well, they don't know numbers, they don't need to know numbers because it's not what they do. But everyone's in some business, right? Like,
everyone's got someone in their family who is that creative person that, you know, to be quite honest, yeah, they may hit their dream, they may not, but it's a long slog before you get that big role, and there's a lot of waiting tables, there's a lot of jobs you got to get during the day that allows you to go off and audition, and,
sure,
you know, the better job you can get that gives you more per hour will better enable you.
Not just that, but when you get that big role, you have to know what the contract means. You have to understand what the numbers say. You have to be able to interpret. You can't just rely on other people because other people, the world is filled with artists and athletes who have
been taken for rides,
been duped, been taken advantage of by the people who are closest to them because they chose not to understand the numbers and they chose to rely on somebody else for, you know, what the contract meant, what the contract says. And all that is, it basically puts you at a competitive disadvantage by not being able to understand some piece of it, some portion of it.
Yeah.
So it's like, it's essentially
it's
like someone
truth.
Handing you a book and you saying, I don't care to know how to read this.
Right.
And
right.
You're saying, you read it for me and tell me what it says in the book. And I'm going to trust you.
Yeah.
And then people saying, oh, great. Well, then the book says this, and therefore you should pay me to take care of you when in fact you're taking advantage of the person.
Dude, unfortunately, a classic example of this very point is mm-hmm. is the, I don't know if you saw it, but there's like anybody who's listening to this can like get on YouTube right now and pull up the Dave Chappelle James Lipton interview.
Uh-huh.
Where he talks about, you know, his career and his life and one of the things there's like a really honest moment where he looks out at all the young aspiring artists and, you know, comedians and people out in the audience. And he's like, look, if you guys think, you know, it's all sunshine and rainbows and, you know, you don't have to understand how to grow a business and just trust people around you, if that's all you think, you're up for a big surprise. And then he walked off the show, as we all know. So, I mean, we could have more years of the Chappelle Show, more years, you know, more content from this creative genius. Because he went to a creative high school in DC,
yeah.
Right? I think he went to like Duke Ellington or something like that. But case in point, he was always at odds with the suits at Comedy Central. He just was, and you know, in his larger comedy career. Anyway, I hear your point. Great point, though. Absolutely.
Yeah, I think people are afraid of doing more quantitative work. And again, I liken it to choosing to be illiterate. You're literally shutting yourself off from a portion of life that will always be there. No matter what field you take up, no matter what your interests are, you will have to understand A, negotiations, B, contracts in some form or fashion, and see what is being said in the contract, which is how you're being compensated for what you do. And that's a financial/numerical component.
Yeah. I mean, I basically say this all the time, like in a lot of presentations and even to my nieces, you know, who are, you know, I've got two who are still in college years, but you want to be more well-rounded than less.
Yeah. Always.
And you always want to be able to exercise, the other side of your brain sooner rather than later.
Yep.
It behooves you, and it puts you on a better trajectory in life, period.
Yeah.
Like, if you just accept that. So anyway, all right, good advice, dude. That's... All right, so... yeah, take us to where you were when you were at the point where you were graduating college, what you were looking to get out of your first role function-wise, industry-wise, and how you're trying to, like, develop yourself, right? And, you know, then go to your second gig and same deal.
Sure. Well, I think, you know, I'd had internships before, but nothing compares to actually working every day, day in, day out for the first time. And I'd worked for a long time, but again, nothing compared to that. So from my first job, again, as an analyst in investment banking, my goal was really to learn, you know, the basic blocking and tackling, understand what the role was, understand what the expectations were, understand, in my case, financial modeling and understanding how companies operated and how capital markets worked, and as well as understand how the professional environment worked, you know, how the people who were successful became successful, things of that nature, you know, just really opening myself up as a bit of a sponge to just trying to learn as much as possible and as quickly a period of time as possible.
Okay. And that was your first kind of gig, right? You just went directly into investment banking.
That's right.
Okay. Was that a large firm, a small firm? Was it like an industry group?
Well, I went into a generalist program at it wasn't a bulge bracket, but it was, you know, it was more of a boutique investment bank where I thought the experience would be a little bit more intense.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Was it, you want to go there with product group, industry group, or because it was a generalist, so you basically worked on all the above.
But yeah.
But put it this way, did you ultimately end up working on transactions that were more like product focused or industry focused? Because I went to a group that did both. So I went to FIG, and that was basically financial institutions. So, you know, that's an industry group. But, you know, we did all the above. So we did our own M&A. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that was kind of like one of the benefits of going to FIG at the time. It was, you know, hey, look, you get M&A exposure, but you'd also get this exposure to this industry.
Sure.
Very busy at the time. So how did you kind of, you know, get on your, like, first few projects and, you know, how did that change and did you switch types of projects towards your second year? Because there's always a big difference between your first year and your second year, I found, usually.
Yes. Well, no, I didn't. Again, it was a generalist program, which meant it was open to industry and transaction type. And the way it works is there was a staffer who would staff the pool of generalists with potential deals.
Everyone's avoiding the staffer on Friday afternoons.
Exactly, everyone avoids the staffer. Right, that's right, because you don't want to get staffed with work on Friday afternoon. Yeah. And you know, at the time that the bank that I worked for, that was a highly coveted position in the generalist program. But I think in retrospect, I would have done what you did, which was work directly for an industry and gotten smart on one industry, because I think one of the drawbacks to the generalist program is that I didn't have a frame of reference for what I was seeing in different industries. So on different transactions, you know, not only are you dealing with different transactions, but a transaction in a different industry, different companies, different characteristics of the companies and the industry, it was a lot to try and digest when I essentially knew nothing anyway. So if I could do it all over again, I would have done exactly what you did, which was gone directly to a specific group, learned, you know, I think the one thing about finance and probably in every single industry or pursuit that one does professionally, it's all about pattern recognition. You know, like, yeah, you want to be able to recognize something and say, based upon my experience, that suggests to me that X will happen.
Right.
And that only happens with experience. you can't learn from a book, you know, what typically one cannot learn from a book what one pattern is. Most of it comes from intuition, and that intuition is based upon experience and having seen it over and over
again. Got to roll up your sleeves and get into it.
Yep. Exactly. So the benefit of being in an industry is you get to see the same companies or the same types of companies and learn the cycles of an industry, as well as seeing the different transactions and so forth. So I think the best way to start recognizing, to start understanding patterns is to see patterns. And that comes from being in one place where you can kind of see things over and over and over again.
Gotcha. No, good advice. Want to move along here. So your third year, you mentioned briefly, was kind of something a little bit more earlier stage.
Uh-huh. That's right.
Yeah. What was, you don't have to say what it was if you can, if you want to, but you know, what's important for me, like a lot of our clients, they kind of, you know, they reach out to us early and they say, look, Kevin, I know I want to apply to business school in a year. I know I'm coming out of finance, or I know I've got this one job on my resume. How should I think about differentiating myself and developing a new skill set
Sure.
in the plug period, in this interim period? What was that part of the decision-making for you to do something a little bit different off the beaten path or something a little earlier stage? And what was it?
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't patterning my career for a business school application. I mean, I wasn't doing it with the thought of, well, what will make me more attractive to business school. I simply wanted to get more entrepreneurial experience. After working in a big organization and feeling very much, and I think everyone does at the junior level, you just feel like a cog. You know, if you...
It can be brutal.
It can be, yeah. You discover yeah. after, you have a head full of steam out of undergrad and you feel very important because you're able to get the job. And then very quickly, you recognize how little you know about everything. And you also recognize that this organization yeah. can move, especially in you know, investment banks, is good or as bad as you are, as much of a star, if you're the number one analyst in your class or the worst analyst in your class, regardless of your ranking, that bank will continue to go forward without you.
Yeah.
If you miss a day, maybe the people on your transaction will be upset, but the work will still get done. Somebody else will just have to do it. That's work exactly will get right. done with or without you.
As bright as you may think you are.
As right. smart as you might be, you might have worked, you know, 10 internships in investment banking. You're ready to be in the next level, although you're a junior analyst. That work will still get done without
right.
you.
Right.
So I wanted something more entrepreneurial. I wanted to see a smaller company. I liken it to, you know, it's the difference between driving or sitting in a bus being driven and driving a go-kart. You want to be able to feel the ground under you. You want to be able to feel you want to have some sense of control over the direction of the wheel, perhaps.
Yeah, like making a larger impact.
Making a larger impact. Yeah. Exactly. Exactly. So that's what I was. That's what I was more interested in. I wanted to do something in a more entrepreneurial environment. I wanted to see a company. I want to contribute to, learn from, and experience a company being built. And that's what I set out to do, and I found an opportunity at a small company. And I learned a lot of valuable lessons.
Was it in the same city, same region?
Yep, sure was. Was also in New York, and it was a financial services internet startup.
Got it. Okay. All right, so now you're at the point where you think you are ready to apply to graduate school.
Yes.
All right, so what were you thinking then, and what'd you do, and why?
In terms of what?
What type of graduate program were you looking to apply to, why, and uh-huh. and how you thought about presenting yourself to those schools, and you know what you got out of that experience?
Sure. Well, I wanted, the way I thought about it was I wanted a program that was heavily geared towards general management. I'd spent a number of years in finance. At the time, I was working for a small private equity firm. And basically what private equity companies do is they take, you know, private capital from pensions, endowments, high net worth individuals, family offices, wealthy family offices, and they invest that money by taking stakes in private companies and helping to build those companies by, you know, taking a more of a passive participation in the development of the company. So you work with management teams, you monitor the company, you monitor the financials, you monitor the strategy, and you, broadly speaking, give advice to the managers of the company on how to better create value with their company. So with that said, I discovered that I was woefully lacking in a lot of areas in terms of my business acumen and expertise. And that came from lack of experience. So on one hand, while I understood the financials of a company very well, I did not know enough about company strategy. I did not know enough about marketing. I did not know enough about operations to feel that I could credibly play any type of advisory role, meaningful advisory role to people who were oftentimes three times my age and if not three times my experience level in their companies. And so that for me was the appeal of business school as well as the network. What I wanted to do was round out the experiences that I developed in finance and develop and get experience in operations, marketing, strategy, et cetera. I mean, there are two ways I saw about going about doing that. One way would be to try and get a job in marketing or in operations,
right?
You know, leaving my firm and then trying to go to, let's just say, Procter & Gamble for 2 years, and then potentially going to GE for 2 years, and then potentially going to someplace else for 2 years. Well, that's not a realistic plan. The other alternative is to go to business school where I could study cases in all these different facets of business and learn in a highly intense environment from other people who had those experiences and draw from those experiences while also sharing my experiences in finance and complementing their potentially lack of experience in finance. So it seemed like a very good, safe environment to try and learn quickly, add arrows to my professional quiver in a lot of areas that I did not want to, you know, did not necessarily want to pursue professionally, but still wanted to gain the knowledge and experience.
Right.
So that was the point of business school. And that's why I wanted a school that focused more on general management versus, you know, over indexing in something like marketing or something like finance or something like accounting. I wanted something where I could, you know, learn from a lot of different areas.
Yeah, I think I definitely felt the same way. I mean, basically, you know, what a lot of, I mean, as you know, in a lot of these blogs out there and a lot of articles that you see on Forbes and Princeton Review, you always get this question that pops up every year of, you know, the value of an MBA. Is it worth it to go back and get an MBA? And the way I thought about answering that question for me was, okay, look, I know I don't want to do this job for the rest of my life, whatever I was doing at age, you know, 25. I knew that, you know, I probably wanted to end up doing something before I died entrepreneurially, mm-hmm. right? And I didn't exactly know what that was going to be, but I knew I would love to draw upon a more expansive network, you know, a couple of different tools that I did not already have. And oh, by the way, I felt like you'd actually learn something out of those 2 years, kind of that you would not have learned if you just opened a book, you know, just because.
Right.
By hearing, you know, so many entrepreneurs and, you know, leaders kind of come through and just, you know, hearing them for an hour talk about, you know, what was written in the paper 2 years ago about some pivotal experience their company experienced, what was it like for them? Mm-hmm. You know, how did they go about making decisions? You know, what was not reflected in that article? What did that feel like to kind of go through every portion of their career, then get to this place, and all of a sudden you're thrown into the mix? And that's information that you can only get by being in a room with someone and having them go there. You can't manufacture that. So, you know, when you compare that against, okay, I'm going to give up this, you know, earning money for 2 years and, yeah, I'm going to take out some debt, you know, but my payoff was, okay, financially I should be able to get you know, a for the next 5 years out of business school, I should be able to make, you know, some money, right? Yeah. That you know, ideally, you know,
someone that should happen. Pay you to do something.
It is a fact that, you know, the college degrees and graduate degrees correlate to higher lifetime earnings. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I felt like, you know what, there's also a non-financial benefit of going through an experience like that as well, that you just cannot capture financially. So that, for me, was why I kind of did it. And that's what we kind of talk about in these presentations.
Certainly.
So, okay. So I went off to basically a school on the other side of the country as you. What would you say your 2 years was like? You know, when you showed up, any shocks you experienced, how would you characterize your first year?
Sure. I think the thing about business school is that I found was that people who have gone through it have had amazing experiences and forget the amount of hard work that they put into it. And I think the first year is a lot more rigorous than people will talk about. And so I was not ready for how rigorous it was. And I think that was, you know, that was the biggest surprise. It's filled with very bright, very ambitious, very upwardly mobile, very competitive people. But what I think people fail to transmit to new students is the fact that they give you more work than you can possibly do on purpose.
Yeah.
And again, everyone who goes is very bright, very capable, and is not used to being challenged in ways like that. But it's worthwhile. And then it, you know, obviously it gets better and you meet wonderful people. But I think that was the biggest surprise was just the volume, the sheer volume of work required in the first, you know, one or two semesters, at the same time as recruiting and meeting classmates and just getting settled in a new environment and a new experience and so forth. So it very much felt like the earth was moving under my feet. And, you know, when you've been working for a number of years, you forget what it's like to have to do homework.
Yeah, you're back in the classroom.
Yeah.
Yeah, you got to do, you know, problem sets and cases. And cases is altogether usually different than what an undergrad experience is.
Exactly.
Like, usually. I mean, most people have had, like, maybe one class in undergrad where it's, like, case intensive and
sure.
It's, you know, it's Socratic and, okay, well, walk us through this and, okay, well, why not? You know, how do you feel? You know, what kind of decision would you make? Yeah. All right. And, okay, can you tell us, like, what portion of the country you went to business school in?
Yeah.
You know, how big your class size was?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
You know, whatever you feel comfortable sharing.
Northeast, class was 900 people.
Okay. Yeah, my class was a little smaller than it. My class was about 366. And,
wow.
Yeah, I went, dude, after, literally my first year was right after the bubble burst. And out in Palo Alto, that's when, obviously, it's ground zero for that,
yeah.
Right? So, not to mention after actual ground zero. Like, my second day of orientation was 9/12.
Wow.
That's something. So, anyway.
Yeah,
that was a whole emotional thing that obviously came out of nowhere. But, yeah, I would say that for me, it was, what shocked me was, you know, professors at the time were really trying to prove the point that, no, you actually have to do problem sets. And it was just culturally, so many people had been pitching their business plan out on Sand Hill Road and it kind of just laughed off, you know, kind of even attending certain classes.
Sure.
And, you know, the pendulum swung, you know, it swung back. But I would say by even in electives, like we had a chance to take electives at the end of first year. And yeah, even those, I mean, you know, it's not as not as rote sometimes as, you know, I mean, there's tons. The great thing about business school for me was, you know, I could take, you know, managing growing enterprises or, you know, what it's like to invest in non-market industries types of courses. And that those were more conversation based. Yeah, cases, but you know, less on the problem set side. You know, it's not like you're getting in there and, you know, doing a bunch of math for 2 hours a night.
Yeah.
So anyway, that was first year for me. How'd you think about your internship year or your internship summer? Sorry.
Let's see. How did I approach that? I got an internship at another investment bank, and I was looking to do something more markets related. So there is a rotational internship that allowed interns to rotate through different parts of the bank. And that was appealing to me because while I felt like I wanted to stay in finance, I wanted to do something closer to the markets that was just a little bit more active and liquid and less execution oriented. I knew I did not want to go back into traditional investment banking, partially because of the culture and the, you know, the work hours. So I felt like this would be a good introduction and a good foray into different parts of the sales and trading business, which I'd never been exposed to before, and that's what I thought about it. So I got an internship doing that.
What did you talk about in your essays to the degree? Did you say you wanted to do a career change? Did you say you wanted to kind of start something on your own and make a larger impact somewhere? Did you kind of go in that direction?
I thought about, in my essays at the time, I thought about doing something more entrepreneurial from the standpoint of working in operations. And at the time that I was writing my essays, that's what I thought I wanted to do. But then I changed my mind. And that is the value of once you get into business school, the moment you get the acceptance and the moment you sign a check saying that you are accepting the position, you have every right to
adjust.
Exactly. Adjust accordingly.
That's funny. Yeah. I came out in, 2003. And so I think that I would say, dude, probably about maybe half of our class had a job upon graduation, and then everyone else got one within 3 months.
Yep.
Not everyone else. There's a slug of people who didn't, but most of those folks had to go down to their second, third, fourth choice. So they clearly had to work in industries and functions that they hadn't planned to. So anyway, it happens.
That's life.
That's life. Exactly. So, okay. So you do the internship, you come back second year. What would you say? This is a good question we get a lot, or this is kind of what I kind of guide people to kind of, you know, allude to when they have their mock interviews. The notion that as second year students have a very different experience than first year students.
Yeah, decidedly so.
So how would you say your second year was different than your first year experience was?
It's certainly more social. There's more control over the experience. You know people better. You know the environment better. I mean, it's like any matriculation. You just are more comfortable, more knowledgeable. You know the system better. You have better access to resources. The learning curve is not as steep. You know, most learning curves are just painfully steep in the beginning, and then things normalize and one feels better about themselves and their environment. Same thing in business school.
Yeah. Okay, moving along here. And by the way, we got about 10 more minutes. Let's pull up at 40 minutes. We're 30 minutes in.
Sure.
That's good. Okay, so now, you know, you're thinking to yourself, okay, you're about to graduate business school and you're about to go off and get that first gig. So how are you thinking about that, and what do you want to grow into, what do you want to develop, and how are you thinking about launching your, you know, the next 10 years of your life, career-wise?
Yeah. Well, I got an offer from the internship that I'd done, and so I went back into finance to start, and I thought it would be a good place to go and learn and so forth and so on. But I think, you know, one of the things I've learned is you don't stop. You definitely have to be aggressive about your learning. And you kind of start all over again at a lower level. And I think part of the difficulty is being an MBA. even worse than undergrad, even worse than being a successful undergrad as a successful MBA or an MBA graduate. You know, I spent 2 years of people, of being around dynamic, can-do, successful individuals and listening to dynamic, can-do, successful individuals. There's rarely a time when, I mean, it's there's selection bias, right? Like, people will come back and speak about difficult times that they've made through.
Right.
No one comes and speaks about a difficult time that they're currently experiencing. No one. There are very, very few stories of entrepreneurs who have come in or business people who have come in and said, I made a colossal mistake, it ruined my life, and now I'm here to tell you about it.
And that's probably the majority of experiences out there.
Yeah,
period.
I mean, there's
you just hear about the winners.
There's one case in the beginning of school, beginning of first year and first semester, and it was a leadership class, and it was a profile on a number of alums. And after 5, 10, and 15 years, their stories got progressively worse. Many people, they gave honest assessments of their careers. The majority of them were not where they wanted to be. They'd committed their lives to their work. Many of them had destroyed their family lives.
Mm-hmm.
Many of the risks that they'd taken professionally had destroyed them, maybe not destroyed them, but set them a number of years back financially. Many of them, even if they hadn't, felt that they weren't as far in their lives as they had believed they would be by that point. And it was a very, very, very sobering case. And it was one of the only that I can think of, if not one of the only that we read over the course of 2 years, that painted a less than rosy picture.
Yeah, because every other one, it's probably like, oh, well, when he sold his first company, he, you know, had this money to invest, and, you know, he analyzed, you know, new industries, and he chose this small, you know, burgeoning, you know, yeah, management team to put his, yeah, it's like, you know, it's like, really? This is the average experience?
Well, everyone's, yeah. I mean, we all, as a culture, as a people, we like to celebrate
winners,
right? But and truthfully, all the cases are about challenges. They're not, the challenge is never, gosh, I've made so much money and I'm so young and so good looking, what do I do with myself? The challenge is, well, here's a challenge, here's a business situation, you know, that I haven't faced before. Now how do I deal with it? And then it's our job to try and pick through it and figure out what we would do. But adding to that, the challenges of life are, you know, what does one do? How does one respond to these challenges? How does one position themselves for success? What does success look like?
You know, I was on this very point. It's really funny because I feel like everyone, you know, gets inspired to do what they want to do, you know, in their life by probably reading case studies and biographies of people that are inspiring. You know, they've done amazing things, and you read about that person or a group of people, and you're like, you know what? Damn, if I could have a career 80% as successful as that person, I'd be happy, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you read that book, and it's, you know, 20 chapters, and from chapter 5 to chapter 10, it's, you know, when he or she was, you know, 30, and then all of a sudden it jumps to when they were 40 and they got into this role, and then it just focuses on, you know, that role and their decisions. But what it doesn't go into is the 10 years between 25 and 35 when they were eating Cheez-Its and they were struggling and they were, you know, doubting themselves and, you know, trying to reposition themselves and what that felt like, you know? So it's kind of like just kind of glosses over that. They don't dive into that portion of the book.
No, they rarely do. They rarely do.
All right, so
I mean, I think a valuable book would actually be a book about people who failed. You know, I mean, just a number of testimonials of people who tried different things and it didn't work, and they, and what does their life look like, and how are they responding, and what are they doing to, and how have they had to adjust their own expectations, how have they coped,
absolutely,
how have they, you know, dealt with it, because I think the reality for most doesn't match what our hopes and dreams are.
That was actually for a long time a question for HBS. I mean, there was the classic, you know, what have you learned from a failure? And then there's, you know, they changed it to mistake for quite a few years. So anyway, definitely. And you know, there's actually some artist or some entrepreneur out there that has something called the Failure Project.
Oh, yeah, the dude who did the 30 days of McDonald's.
Yeah, right, exactly. And it profiles people who, like, tried new art forms. And, you know, this, like, one girl says, oh, I want to try stand-up comedy. And it shows her bombing for, like, you know, a few shows. And, yeah, just kind of what you can learn from failure kind of thing.
What's that guy's name? Yeah.
Well, yeah, we can Google it. All right, so real quick, there's some other questions we get, you know, a lot. I think people find value in. What is the most memorable guest lecture or guest speaker that you can kind of remember from business school? For me, it was twofold. It was when, actually three. I mean, these are probably, it's going to sound corny, but they all kind of have a tie. Buffett and Munger came, and I throw them in the same bucket because of Berkshire. And then when Steve Jobs came, and just real quick on Buffett and Munger, obviously it's Buffett and everyone, you know, loves him who's in business and... But I remember Munger came, and the guy, like, he was like 80 years old then. So now he has to be pushing 86, 87 or something like that. Yeah, anyway, he came to one of our classes, popped in a chair and sat down. It amazed me how, you know, you run into, like, older guys, you know, out there on the street or in your family or whatever, and they're still very sharp. Mm-hmm. You know, they're still very quick-witted, very sharp, you know, they're good at... He struck me as one of those guys. Same, obviously, with Buffett. But his personality was so prickly. It was like he made no bones about calling certain managers idiots. Mm. You know? Like, he's got this book called, you know, Damn Straight or Damn Right. Mm-hmm. You know, that definitely is his personality. And he's kind of like the alter ego of Buffett. So anyway, that struck me. It was like, oh, wow, this guy has this personality that's not all rosy and, oh, you can do it. It's like, no. In your face, look, people screw up. Let's be honest about it.
Yeah.
And, you know, let's have a sobering view of, you know, how to do this. That was one. When Jobs came, it was 2002 at the time, I think it was 2002. Everyone thought he was going to come, and the whole school came out. Everyone thought he was going to come and talk about the iPod, mm-hmm. when in reality, for that hour, he spoke about iTunes, which in hindsight, we know, you know, change the landscape of the music industry.
Sure.
You know, enormously. And he viewed the iPod simply as a device. It was just a machine. But changing the landscape, he was much more excited about. And we did not get it at the time. Huh. I remember afterwards, a bunch of us went to, like, lunch or dinner, and we were like, damn, yeah, the guy is psyched about this iTunes thing. Oh, wow, yeah. Well, we wanted to hear more about, you know, this little device. It looks cool. No one's seen anything like it before. Yeah, we've got MP3 players, but this, you know, is a little bit better. So, a testament to his ability vision. His vision. So, anyway, that's the answer for me. What would the answer be for you?
I think the most... so many speakers were so powerful, but I think the one thing that still stands out to this day is we had Jeff Immelt, the CEO of GE, come and speak at our graduation. And I'd forgotten probably 98-99% of what he said, with the exception of a couple of jokes, but except for one thing, which was, I mean, basically in the midst of his speech, spoke directly to the graduates and said, you know, just playtime is over. It's time to go out there and get hungry and be aggressive and hustle and be prepared to work twice as hard as you think you should and be prepared to compete. Like, you are competing. Everything is a competition henceforth. You know, there are people who want your job. There are people who won't like you. There are people who don't think you've earned the right to be where you are. You probably haven't. So, but one way or the other, you will earn where you end up.
Yeah.
So, you know, tie your shoes up tight and get ready to run hard.
Yeah.
And it was a very sobering, you know, there are very few times in business school when people aren't saying to you, oh, follow your dreams, live your life the way you see fit. You can do it. You're going to be a success. You're already a success for being here.
Right. A lot of ego stroking.
A lot of sunshine.
Particularly at the top five schools. You
exactly.
Know, it's like, oh, you made it here. You know, one amongst.
Therefore,
blah, blah, blah.
You can do anything. And he was saying, no, you can't do anything. You can't just do anything. You have to work.
That's the knock against young MBAs in any job out there, by the way.
Yeah.
It's like they want to put everything in a quadrant and, you know, feel like they need to be the right-hand person to the CEO immediately.
Immediately. Yeah. Well, and he, of course, he spoke about his career. He spoke about, you know, pulling all-nighters and the where he had to go and, you know, potentially fix some sort of, I don't know what they were, washing machines or something like that. And, you know, they had to issue numbers at one point, and he had to go and, like, literally count inventory and, you know, spending weeks of all-nighters doing stuff like that and working his way up. And
here he is, this young HBS MBA.
And he's an HBS MBA, and he's out there with a clipboard counting. Yeah,
yeah,
counting. And he talks about that, and he's like, he's now the CEO of GE, one of the most powerful companies in the world. Not because he's the smartest, just the smartest, or just because he, you know, has the best background, but because he was willing to do what it took to be successful. So if you want to do what it takes to be successful, you're going to work.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Well, last question. We'll wrap this sucker up, man. Pretend like this is like, you're submitting like a 2-3 minute snippet of like your version of a TED speech. You know, so it's everyone's gone to whatever grad school they went to, whether it's business school, law school, public policy, whatever. People are, you know, beginning their careers, right? And, you know, what would you say people should keep in mind that they don't hear every day? Aside from what you just said, you got to work hard, clearly, that's a great message. But, you know, what else would you say people need to keep in mind for those first 10 years coming out of their 20s, would you say? So something that you maybe didn't really realize as much. For me, it was... I'll just go...
Sure,
so
go ahead. Go ahead.
Gather your thoughts. For me, it was... I mean, as you know, I mean, dude, I went, you know, worked for a private equity-backed healthcare company. So they had a portfolio company, healthcare services, and the whole idea was, oh, get some operating experience, actually learn how to do something, blah, 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 you know, lead a team. Went back to banking 2 years. The whole idea was, okay, get a little bit more experience, save some money, because I ultimately want to be an entrepreneur. Fine. Left in 2006, and this is like my foray into entrepreneurship. Took a couple of years to figure out, oh, wow, this is tougher than I thought. It's going to take longer than I thought. And I ended up, kind of doing work that touches, you know, lives a little bit more, which is what I wanted to do through admissions consulting, but also... You know, started my creative outlet, you know, in becoming a performing artist, you know, doing stand-up comedy on the side. And now, you know, I'm in a position where, okay, wow, I can look back and say, whew, damn, thank God I got through that. But I would probably say my version of that is, look, you know, I'd say this to, like, if I had a niece or a nephew, you know, or a younger cousin, you know, I'm having a, you know, a coffee with them. I'd say, look, guys, look, man, you know, whatever you do, you know, just be sure that you try to expand and grow and develop new muscles, different sides of the brain,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
Try to do something that you are emotionally connected to, because mm-hmm. you're always going to be put in a position where you're competing against people that are going to be better at whatever it is you're doing. They're just, you know, odds are you're not going to be the best, you know, skill set wise. So the only way you can compete with that person is, you know, for you to love it so much, you just have your head down, you work at it so much longer, you can therefore start building up that skill set. And then you'll be able to find yourself in a position where, wow, you have gotten better. Wow, you can use that pair of pliers as good as the next guy who just naturally can use a pair of pliers. Wow. Now, but you've got to have that kind of passion about something, you know? And so figure out for yourself how to merge those two, stuff you're kind of sort of good at, stuff you are emotionally connected to, mm-hmm. and focus right there in the middle, apply your Malcolm Gladwell 10,000 hours, it's going to take some time, and if you can figure that out sooner than later, you'll be, you know, on a great trajectory.
Yeah.
That's my version of it. So
sure.
what would your version of that be?
I think my version from a professional standpoint would be, you know, I think you've nailed it. I wouldn't say anything different. I think from a personal standpoint, I would say, you know, I would just remind listeners of the, you know, the same kind of millionaire next door principles or millionaire, you know, whatever that you learn from those books, that remind them that wealth is a function of savings, not of income. And rainy days will happen. And the only thing that really gets you through rainy days is comfortable cash. And that would be it. I would encourage people to save as aggressively as possible. I think it's easier said than done because we're all influenced by a very highly consumerist culture. But I would say that to, you know, to be forward thinking, one needs to be, you know, a little cautious in their approach, and in order to do so, one should probably save as much money as possible, and that will get them through like the lean and the hard times. Because the good times take care of themselves. All you have to do is really worry about the bad times. Good times are always easy.
Yeah.
Bad times are the things that fray your confidence, your ability to perform at the highest level. Like, that's where the stress ends up creating fractures in your world.
Yeah. Yeah. And that spills over into personal relationships, family,
all the above. Yeah. But the only way to the best umbrella for the bad times and for the rainy days is cash. And the only way to control your cash, you can't control, so, you know, some people will make more, some people will make less. But what they can't control is how much they can save of that.
Right.
So that's what I would do. I would focus on the savings as much as on the earnings.
Right. Yeah. Good advice. All right, cool. All right, man. Thanks a lot. This is, I think we're 51 minutes into this. So, great. That's Delano. He's a very accomplished professional out there. He's an investor now, went off to business school. He's so kind to give us some insights into his personal life. Thank you again,
man. Happy to be here.
I appreciate it. All right, guys. So, this was your podcast for this week. I'm Kevin Williams, the Oneida Admissions Consulting Podcast, and talk to you guys on the other side.